Hey Central Ohio, the nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
We got him aboard the boat. Rick had that what for talk with him. I think the first indication that he had that who we were is when they were loading him on the boat. I said his name and I said, "You've been indicted by a federal grand jury. We have a warrant for your arrest." Didn't waste any time. Immediately went out to sea, brought him back to St. Croix in the rough waves. And then the incident happened where Rick's crotch got sprayed by OC spray and a combination of OC spray and salt water. The case agent was thrown up into his vest, but got him back to St. Croix and began debriefing him.
Hey guys, here we are for episode 217, but this is the fourth part of this particular interview with Chris Howell, former chief of police with the Virgin Island Police Department in St. Croix, which we all thought was the garden spot of the world. We thought that was Garden Eden, but we're learning that it's not quite what it's led to believe. And we have Rick Rambo, who's a retired DE agent, who's more of a bullet magnet than anything else. But we've had a good time talking. But we left you yesterday where Fluffy's dad, and if you remember, Fluffy is the guard dog, this little bitty yappy dog, and you know how they are, how loud they are. These guys have set up a trap for him, and he took the bait, and they now have him in custody. We had poor Rick here had his OC spray under his vest, and they hit a tough wave, and it broke the top off of it. And so now he's doused in OC. That's not good. And another agent on the boat gets seasick whenever he sees the ocean. So I'm not sure why he's even in out there in St. Croix. But he's doing his thing, throwing up in the side of his vest. But they got Fluffy's dad here in custody, and that's where we left yesterday. So, guys, I'm going to turn it over to you, and let's find out what that led to.
We got him aboard the boat. Rick had that what-for talk with him. I think the first indication that he had that who we were is when they were loading him on the boat, I said his name and I said, "You've been indicted by a federal grand jury. We have a warrant for your arrest." And, didn't waste any time. Immediately went out to sea, brought him back to St. Croix, in the rough waves. And then, the incident happened where Rick's crotch got sprayed by OC spray and, a combination of OC spray and salt water. case agent was thrown up into his vest, but got him back to St. Croix, and began debriefing him. And the law requires that we bring him to the closest magistrate. So the plan was to debrief him and then get him on a customs plane, bring him back to St. Thomas for appearance with the magistrate. And at the same time, we go back to St. Thomas with a team, 100 large or more, execute search warrants on the rest of his organization and get all those guys in custody, which we successfully did. So the debrief of the guy, it went well. And then he eventually stopped cooperating. But by then the damage was done. So we felt like that case was done and over with. But there were always things going on in the background.
Yeah. Chris, just to jump in real quick, that was one of those ones as well. Like when we talked earlier about Olympia Casa, that the case Olympia Casa and the beach party, how you just kept going and going and going for like days with no sleep. And what have you. That was the case with this operation here. I think we totaled 72 hours on that one. I know I had a 30-minute sleep time when we were on the helicopter. I think we were at a helicopter River Wing heading from St. Croix to St. Thomas to go do that night off. Those guys were heading over on the boat. The arrest team on Hell and I and a couple of people were on the helicopter. I think that's the only sleep that I had in 72 hours was on the helicopter on the way over, just kind of, bouncing off the head. I was a bull cow, maybe you're a bull cow, but bouncing off that. And that was the one thing I learned from that sleep deprivation, 72 hours worth, is that at that point, when I drove home, when we were finally done and you knew you were finished with that and we're just going to go home for at least a sleeping session, I remember everything was orange, like from being up that long. It's the Caribbean, so everything is blue and green and beautiful flowers and colorful. All the houses are pinks and yellows, and everything after 72 hours, everything looked like those old beta blocker, like fishing glasses they used to have with the orange lens. Everything was orange. Everything was orange. But anyway, there's a little thing, a lesson about sleep deprivation and what it does to your head.
For me, I would feel it in my legs. My legs would feel like lead after you go several days without sleep. That's how I felt it. I never had the orange view of the world, but not to be crass
or anything, but I don't know how. I think I slept a total of 18 hours. When I went to bed, I went into a coma.
Wow.
And I don't know how, not to be crass about it, how you don't poop the bed when you sleep for 18 hours and don't wake up. But 18 hours, I think, is how long I ended up in the sack until I finally woke up.
Holy cow.
Caught crowing. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. So we thought the case was over, and that case was was just going through the judicial process at that point. Everybody was in custody, high bails on everybody. It was locally indicted. We didn't have a federal nexus to get it outside the U.S. Virgin Islands, so they were going to be tried locally. The source in the case was supposed to relocate upon takedown, but he had lived in the Virgin Islands his whole life, and he decided simply that he wasn't going to go. And everything we did to try to convince him he needed to leave, he just refused. So about the same time, I got a call from some of my guys that I worked with Royal Virgin Islands Police Department over in Tortola. And they had information that they had two individuals that were Colombian, and they were in the British Virgin Islands. And the information they received is that they were going to murder a police officer over in the BVIs, then come over to the Virgin Islands and murder me, that there was a contract on my life. And so I don't think I even told the supervisors or anything. I was like, well, you better get him in custody before we get murdered here. So they went out looking for him, and they grabbed him up. And they found out that their fingerprints matched the fingerprints that were left in the van with 1,260 kilos in Tortola. So they were involved in that shootout as well. And so they charged him with that 1,260 kilo shipment back in June of 96. And so we figured, all right, well, the murder contract's been foiled. A couple months goes by, and they're transporting him to a hearing over in the court. Right, it wasn't even a couple months; a couple weeks. They're transporting him to a hearing over in the court, and the van that is doing the transport gets ambushed by guys with high-powered rifles, and they break the guys out, and then drive the van off of a cliff over in Tortola. The correction officers that were transporting survived; were actually uninjured, but the two hitmen that were involved in the Tortola shootout and they were trying to carry out the contract on my life and a life of a police officer over in Tortola. They were to the wind. They were gone. And so, so while that was going on, I get a call one morning, from a detective with VIPD, and they say that they asked, do you know a guy by this name? And I said, why, what do you got? And I knew that was the source for the case that we had taken down, Fluffy's owner and all the co-conspirators in that, the same guy we were trying to get to relocate off island, and he refused to go. And they said, well, he's been murdered and he was just gunned down last night. So I said, all right, let me call you back. And I hang up the phone and I immediately call the case agent. And I said, hey, your source just got gunned down. And so we go to that scene, and his SUV he was driving. His girlfriend was in the passenger seat, and at least one individual with a high powered rifle opened fire on the vehicle when he turned the corner into his neighborhood. And he had been shot multiple times. His girlfriend was shot as well, but she survived. He was dead on arrival. So he was gone. It didn't, the prosecutor assigned to the case, as I said, was a great prosecutor, and she agreed to continue with the case. And we were actively investigating it, but, it appeared that the individuals that were involved in that murder were the same individuals that Rick and Diaz, were investigating, that we installed the tracking transponder on their boat. So, by this point in that investigation, we had executed search warrants.
So to set the stage for the folks out there, you've probably seen mafia movies, or you've seen the gangland assassinations where somebody gets shot in a restaurant or shot in a car. And I know Chris and I, we went out to the scene and we were there right on the scene where the CS had been shot and killed. But it had been hours and hours since this had happened in the nighttime. And that's the next morning. We go to see the vehicle itself over at the VIPD and their lot. I'll let Chris talk about that if he wants, but their evidence lot leaves some things to be desired. But this gives you an idea of how bad this fellow had been shot up. I think they were using maybe a 7.62, like an AK-47. There's probably two rifles involved, two semi-automatic rifles or automatic rifles involved. But we're hours later, we get there, and there's still a steady stream of blood dripping out the bottom of the car from like around it, gone through and then gone through the floorboards. But I mean, that's how bad it was that hours and hours later, there's still blood. So that's how serious that they were about assassinating him. It was that bad, that two automatic weapons, that kind of carnage. They meant to really, really make sure on this fella.
Yeah. So the vehicle, as Rick had said, I mean, they didn't spare any ammunition. They went, looked like full auto into the vehicle. But in processing that scene with VIPD, we noticed that there was no brass. Either they picked up their brass or they had brass catchers on the weapons, but no brass to be found. So there was no way to do comparisons.
Is that something that you normally saw down there with those automatic weapons? Was they had brass catchers attached to them?
No, I think that's the only time I've seen that. So, and we spent hours on that scene looking, you know, and Dana Rodenhauer was there with FBI, and she's, you know, she was a evidence tech for FBI. And, you know, we went as far as to, there was a small field next to where the gunfire was and where he was driving. And we suspected that they were kind of like hiding out in that field and kind of rose up from the tall grass. And, we got to the point where we were using metal detectors, and we went through with weed whackers and cut all the grass down and pulled it out of the area just so we could try to recover even to single shell case, and we got nothing. So that leads me to believe that they had brass catchers on the weapons. So,
holy cow.
But as Rick said, they were serious. They wanted him gone. And we suspected that the same organization that Rick and Diaz were investigating was likely responsible for it, because they, you know, they would take contract work like this. So things in that case were starting to get, you know, starting to pick up as well. And that investigation wasn't exactly overt, but it wasn't covert either. Like, they knew we were on them, and we had executed search warrants and gotten a large sum of money, out of the lead target's house, and, seized a bunch of other stuff. And so the lead target in that case definitely knew that he had heat on him. And so that case was actually being worked by Rick. Rick could probably go more detail about that, but it was, again, this is during that time frame, that 2 years where the task force was just firing on all cylinders. We had multiple major cases working all at the same time. So everybody's staying really busy. And it also, during that time, you know, the disconnect between the federal guys and VIPD became abundantly clear. You know, there was this, I don't know, maybe you call it this thought that there should be a spirit of cooperation and equal sharing of information. But I think Rick would attest that we didn't feel that way at all. We were providing information in, but nothing was coming back out, and we weren't granted access to case files over at VIPD on the source's murder and the subsequent things that were happening. And there was also the lead target in Rick and Diaz's case had a police officer for a sister. And there was no indication she was dirty or she was involved in it, but just the thought that, you know, it's something you need to watch, you know, it definitely, there was a separation. And we started to see during surveillances, we were seeing police officers showing up on these lead targets' house. And some of these guys they're very well known among VIPD, the entire island, that these are gang members. This is organized, you know, organized crime gang members who are bad guys who have multiple homicides under their belt. And we're seeing VIPD officers, you know, hanging out with them at their houses. And we're getting this huge attitude whenever we're bringing that to the attention of VIPD management, saying, look, you know, and I wouldn't say VIPD management was unsupportive of us, but they were like, there's nothing we can do. They can hang out with who they want. And I generally believe that there was like, there was a separation. You couldn't really tell where, corruption stopped and fear began, because I really generally believe at this point that organization had everybody was, it was widely accepted that these guys had kidnapped, tortured, murdered, and dismembered a police officer. And I think that a lot of people, they weren't inside of the police department. They weren't dirty. They were just, they were concerned for their families. They were concerned for themselves, and they just didn't want anything to do with that. So yeah. Rick could talk maybe more about that.
The members of this group, almost every one of the core members, they were infinitely cruel. They were sociopaths. Several of them, they enjoyed what they did. When they hurt people, they enjoyed it. They were, if you're going to have a movie bad guy, if you're going to have the truth personification of evil, something that in the DSM-5 Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the psychological, you'd have to write a new chapter on several of these guys. They were just world-class evil. And yeah, and like Chris said, you know, St. Croix, how long is St. Croix? Is it 7 by 17? I can't remember the measurement of the island.
I'm not sure what the measurement is. 87 square miles, though.
Yeah, so it's not a very big place, and you can't hide there, you know. And so if you're a police officer there, everybody knows where you live. It doesn't take long to learn people's patterns. So if you're good and you start doing your job well and they come after you, it's just a matter of time. Wow. You can be really good. You can be the most tactical, you know, operator in the world, but you're going to have trouble. So these, you know, like I said, these guys are bad. They are bad news. I mean, at that point, I've been a cop in Pittsburgh, you know, been with DEA, been in multiple shootings. And these guys were just world-class violators. My partner, Angel Diaz, I don't know, except for Chris, I don't know if I could have more perfect partner in the Virgin Islands than Angel. He's former 82nd Airborne, so us being both former military, you know, we got along real well. I was a combat engineer. He was an airborne infantry. And we were just kind of like Chris, his brother. Still, they're the family that I didn't have. And but so Angel and I, we started doing old-school policing. Like Chris said, we had limited resources. You couldn't trust, you know, you didn't know who to trust. And most of the time you didn't trust. We even had information from the British Virgin Islands, from their law enforcement there, that one of the officers who's actually a lieutenant on the department for VIPD was actually in bed with our organization. To some extent, we didn't know what. We couldn't use the confidential source on their island because he was a national security source. So what that means is, he's on the side of the house where they're looking at, like, you know, counterterrorism in the wake of 9/11. This guy's that valuable. They can't compromise him on a criminal case over in the U.S. But they could tell us that you need to look out for this guy and not trust him and whatever. So those are the kind of things you were facing. But so Angel and I, we went old school, and we would go out after hours. We would take one of the vans or one of the other HIDA vehicles, and we would go out and go into the neighborhoods that had the bad guys in them. And we would look for target vehicles, and we'd find a reason because he had local police powers, you know, being a task force agent, Angel being VIPD. So we'd just pull them over, traffic infractions, whatever we could to try to get guns, drugs. We're looking to cooperate somebody. We're looking into getting somebody into a bad place where we can compromise them and then have them start working for us. I think one of the stops we did, I don't think I ever saw Angel look nonplussed. I'm going to use a college word. I never saw Angel look nonplussed before, or embarrassed, but it was dark at night. We both had our submachine guns that night because, you know, who we're going after, their AK-47s and who knows what. We pull over one of our target cars for a pretty good infraction. And like I said, dark at night in a bad neighborhood. We get out, we walk up, and we're on our P's and Q's because you never know what's going to happen with these guys. We walk up, end up being Angel's priest. we walk up on Angel's priest with Colt SMGs, like two handguns, like cross, kind of like, you know, buccaneer style, you know, whatever. And I don't know if he did confession the next week. I don't know if he absolved himself of it or if he can pay. I forget to pay a reparation. I forget to call it the church. But anyway, yeah, so there was that little lighthearted moment on the traffic stops. We even planned ourselves. We knew that there was a fellow who was originally, and I think, I can't remember if he was from Syria. He was from the Middle East. I can't remember which country. I think maybe Syrian, but, he owned a really big gas station mid island, and they had a pretty big mansion on the island. But, this fellow was like a gangster wannabe. He was their age, or the same people that we have in our, you know, commission organization. He's their age, and he liked to ingratiate himself to them. And so they'd hang out, you know, near that gas station. They'd come in, they'd do things in the gas station. So we found a building that we could kind of like get at the roof on. across the way from it. And we would do into the midnight hours, late morning, you know, zero dark 30 hours. We would lay on top of that building with our night vision and with our, you know, with our cameras and try to get something. We did a full court press, going after these guys. You could talk about the case for a long time. You could see, you could really see that. I mean, it would take hours to really tell the whole tale of the case, but, even to the U.S. Attorney's office, I'll talk about this in a different venue, but that U.S. Attorney's office down there, all I will say is that was something else. I've told veteran DEA and FBI guys that have been abroad, worked in some pretty skeevy places, the things that happened with that office. And they just look at me like when a dog makes a funny noise, or when a dog hears a funny noise, and they're like, brrr, like this. You'll tell this story exactly as it happened to these guys and gals that have, they're no shrinking violets. And they look at you with that dog on the, that dog look, that brrr look. And they just, they're like, there's no way that could happen under a U.S. flag. And they're like, it happened under a U.S. flag. Ultimately, in the end, we start getting too close to them. We had multiple sources come in that were independent of each other, coming in saying, these guys are going to roll on you guys if you get too close to their hierarchy and what have you. And so they started surveilling houses. They surveilled my house. Chris and I were out to dinner with our wives one night, and one of the dirty VIPD guys that we knew was dirty was sitting, and he had no reason to be where he was near where I got. My house is a cul-de-sac right near the water in the mountains there. He's sitting right there. Nothing happens there. It's a cul-de-sac in a secured neighborhood with guard gates. And he made it in there, and he's there watching. So wow. Those are the kind of things that you had to.
Well, and Diaz got followed as well. He was out with his wife and kids, and he called me, and I think his wife actually called me, and she says, there's a vehicle following us, and Diaz is going to drop us to the house and go after it. And he started driving fast, and the vehicle stayed with him, and it was obvious they were up to no good. And he got to the house, dropped the wife and kids off, immediately took off after them, and they got away from him. But that was like, those were all in hindsight, they're red flags of what was about ready to happen. And
these are all documented. You know, we had to do a lot of different reports and a lot of memos and things like that. They were all documented. And the day before, we'll talk about Angel. We talked about before about Angel's father being shot up in the previous podcast that we did. But my partner Angel, ultimately, they came after Angel's truck and shot his father in it. They didn't know that it wasn't Angel in the truck. But nevertheless, the day before they machine gun Angel's vehicle, I had the same thing happen. I was heading home from the federal building, that big Chevy 2500, big pickup truck that you can't miss. And I had a vehicle get on behind me. And so I started making some of those turns that if you follow through that turn, maybe if you follow through that turn for sure. And I did what Angel did. I had the luxury of not having family with me, but I had my M4, fully automatic rifle and all my gear. They were like in a smaller vehicle, like a Geo Tracker, like an island vehicle, like a Geo Tracker, one of those smaller SUV types. I just turned around and started chasing them in that big 2500. And of course they zipped away. They ultimately get in some places I couldn't follow them in that big truck, narrow European style streets on St. Croix. And they got away, but that was the day before. That was the day before the actual shooting. So I guess we'll go ahead and get into that. So Chris and I, one of the things on St. Croix, the pay scale wasn't that great for VIPD and what have you. So some people worked other jobs, kind of like we did. Like even in Pittsburgh, I worked overtime jobs to make ends meet. And so Angel and his wife worked in overtime, two overtime jobs. And so a lot of the times we'd get the kids, or we'd get like Angel Jr., Angel's son. I think Angel Bombi was his nickname. Bombi was what, about probably 11 at that time? 11
yeah,
years old?
About, and Helico was just a year or two younger. But they were like our kids. I mean, we used to, yeah. I mean, Diaz used to joke that he'd, you know, Rick and I were the only people he trusted with his kids, you know, and we used to go out, I'd take him to the beach. We'd do a lot of stuff together. And that particular day Rick's talking about, we took him rappelling. We took Angel rappelling and pretty much had him out all day and kind of exhausted him. I'll let Rick tell a story and I'll jump back in how I found out about this whole thing. But
yeah, brave little kid, 11 years old. And we took him out into the rainforest. Way up in the mountains there, they had this, it's called Creaky Dam, right? Was that the name of it? Mm-hmm. Creaky yep. Dam? Yeah. It's a dam way up in the mountains in the rainforest. The dam's back this lake that's way up surrounded by jungle type rainforest and all that. But, we took Bombi out there and we had all of our rappelling gear and we took him onto that dam. And It's not a super safe place. If you fall off of it, you're gone. You're gone. Yeah. This little kid was his dad's. You know, he was his dad's son. There was no doubt about it. We get out there, and I mean, it was funny because we didn't have any rappelling gloves that were like not like Mickey Mouse size looking things, right? They were all big for a little kid like that. But we got him all geared up, and he was fearless. We ended up I rappelled down the dam to the bottom, and then we ended up having him, and Chris had him all rigged up. And anyway, we had it was a really good day. It was just a good day. We spent the whole day at that dam laughing and rappelling and whatever. And then we all went back to Angel's house. They were done at that point. We go in and pretty much the whole family was there. You know, the dad was there. And Angelica, the wife, Carmen, we're all there. Well, it's dark and everybody's leaving. And as I recall, Bombi wanted to go with his grandfather. They're going to take the little pickup truck that Angel and I went and did fishing out of and go to the beach and launch a little skiff on the beach. This is a little island truck. And, so his father borrowed the truck that night. Bombi wanted to go with, but Carmen, his mom, is like, no, you had fun all day with Rick and Chris. You're going to, you know, brush your teeth, wash your hands and go to bed or do homework or whatever. And so he ended up, you know, luckily being left at home. So we all leave, we go home, and I'd gotten home and I get the phone call. Majin, which is his dad, Angel's dad's nickname. Majin's been shot, like really bad. And so I know exactly what happened. I know exactly what happened at this point. I got every gun that I had. I had several of my personally owned weapons down there because I knew that I might get it going out of the place. I mean, I know if I was them, it would be a night of the long knives. Like during Queen Elizabeth times, where they just did away with all the baddies in the court that were causing the queen problems. Like in one night, they were all gone. Whether you're sitting on the crapper or you're doing whatever. So I left out of there and I had a lot of weapons on my P's and Q's, went out a secret way, got to the hospital. And of course, by this point in time, Chris was there. I was there. Everybody who was a somebody that gave a crap that was operator or whatever, DEA, FBI, everybody was there. And Einhell's dad had been shot up really badly. What they did was they waited for that vehicle to get away for to leave the house and get into kind of like a remote part of the island heading home. And they came up alongside in a full size Dodge pickup truck. And they had two automatic weapons. As they come alongside, they just open up, light them up and you drive on the left hand side of the road on St. Croix, right? So they're coming around on the right, and there's two guys in the bed with automatic weapons, and they just light that little tiny two-seat Nissan or one of those real small pickup trucks. Just light them up. And the big guy upstairs was there that day, because the way it works is they're going by spraying him down. To the best of my recollection, he had four wounds that went across his face, and they were 223 skimming. Like one went creased his lip, one hit like here on the nose, like right here on the web of your nose, and left like a thing here, and then across the bridge of the nose like that, just leaving the edge of the bullet for us. Luckily, those bullets were ball ammunition, solid ammunition that doesn't mushroom when it hits, and had gone more than likely through the glass so they didn't tumble sideways. So he had clean this, but the one that was almost the deal breaker, one went through the door metal and hit him in the arm and clipped the brachial, or clipped the major artery in the arm.
Yeah, he took one to the jaw too, because they had wired his jaw shut for quite a while, but he had both arms were damaged and never really recovered. So, but Rick's right. I mean, it's remarkable that he survived it.
Because any one of those wounds, if a 223 hits you as fast as going, it's going to cause a lot of kinetic energy damage. And the fact that they just went, most of them went like that.
Just great.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, and the vehicle was tinted, and so they didn't know who was in it. They just, and normally Angel would drive that vehicle, so they assumed it. And I remember I think Diaz called me first, and it was late at night. I was already asleep. The phone's ringing, and I pick it up, and before I can even say hello, I hear Diaz go, he's something like, "Where are you?" And he goes, "My dad's been shot." And I yelled back, "Are you hit?" And it was silence on the phone, which seemed like a very long time. And then I yelled it again. "Have you been hit?" And he goes, "No, but my dad's bad, and I don't think he's going to make it." And I said, "Where are you?" And he goes, "I'm heading to the hospital with him." And so I jumped into, we had a Z24 that I don't know why I was driving that night, but the thing was fast as hell. I did the same thing as Rick. I grabbed all the guns and ammunition I could carry, jumped in that Z-24 and shot down the mountain where I lived. And I came up on the scene first, and you could see it was a long stretch of roadway right next to a school. School on one side, just heavy, like jungle bush on the other side, if you will. And the pickup truck was still in the middle of the road with the doors open. And I kind of ran through the police line tape, and I was looking for Diaz. And one of the forensic officers there goes, they weren't after his dad, they were after him. And I was kind of like numb for a second. I looked at the vehicle and I saw all these entry holes in the windshield, and there was like 50 or more of high powered entry holes through the windshield and then through the doors itself. And the words that escaped my mouth is like, no one survived this. I literally, that came out of my mouth, and I saw like a pool of blood next to the driver's door. And when Angel Senior got shot, he rolled out of the door, and he had a 357 on him, and he emptied emptied that on the vehicle. And that's probably what got them continuing on. I think if he had just fallen out of the vehicle, they would have come and finished him off. But yeah. And so now, I jumped back in the vehicle, went to the hospital, and I met Diaz there with his wife and two kids. And, you know, to this day, the memory of his daughter in particular, Angelica, you know, is just like burned into my head. It's just, it's like I saw her face and you could see the worry on her face and shock. And, you know, the guys started arriving one by one, I'll let Rick continue the story from there.
Let me ask you a question though, before you do, Rick, were these guys using brass catchers like the other people?
No.
And the second question is, did the chief from VIPD show up?
He was. Yep. He was there. And a lot of that brass ended, see, they were perched in the back of a pickup truck. And I'm not sure how many people there were. I think there was at least two, maybe more. And they were emptying into that vehicle. The windshield alone, I remember that forensic was taken and marking each one of the entry holes into the windshield, and there were over 50. There were over 50 into that windshield alone. So,
and they did the dowel rods. I recall there was how they put the dowel rods through to show the path of travel, and it looked like some kind of Jenga game or something. I mean, it was.
I'll bet.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hey, Central Ohio, the nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
Well, and what was like heavy on everybody's mind is that there was that last minute decision that Angel would stay home instead of go home with his father. And we looked at that passenger side door, and had he been seated there or even sleeping there, there's no doubt he would have been.
I looked at it. There were multiple holes in that seat where Bombi would have been sitting. He would have taken at least seven. Right through the chest and neck.
Wow. And, you know, people that don't believe in miracles, you just heard about a miracle there.
And, you know, I'm not talking tough or being macho, but I will tell you this much. I was a younger man then, and, you know, your head doesn't work the same. But if something had happened to Bombi on that one, I don't know if I'd be sitting right here looking at you on a camera. I don't know if Chris would either. I look back to that. I think that if Bombi had been murdered in that one, I think things might have been different with the way things turned out. I think things would have turned out differently if Bombi had been killed.
Yeah.
That's
understandable. I mean, good Lord. I mean, God gives us gifts, but you can only take so much.
Yeah. So the whirlwind after this, you know, you would have expected for DEA to send every pipe hitter they had to that island, lock arms from beach to beach, from north and south, and sweep across that island. And if you ever even saw a picture of crack or cocaine or whatever, you're going to be in fear of having things happen, right? Never saw that. There was a very, very, for what it was, meager response.
They sent three.
What year was this?
Three guys.
It's 2004. And I will tell you this, I need to do a shout out. I haven't seen Charlie since then, but the DEA response was tepid, and that's giving him a lot. And I love DEA. The problem is when you have that perfect storm in management where they're deer in the headlights, it affects everybody. And that wasn't my experience for all of the rest of my DEA career. I had spotty times where you'd have a supervisor that was just so-so, or they're in it for for whatever reasons they were in it for. But by and large, in my 25 years with DEA, I had supervisors that I would have gone into, you know, through Hell's Gate with. They were unbelievable. But unfortunately, during this particular time period, you had upper level management that were like division level management that were just like deer in the headlights. And we'd told them about the CSS. We documented, with reports. I was the JTTF. I was the Joint Terrorism Task Force guy for VI, the rep. And we were doing reports. We were doing it through the DEA reporting system. And the response from upper level management, you kids have watched too many movies. We're telling them, hey, we're getting reports that they're going to roll on us when we get into the hierarchy. And we're being told, and we're young, respectful agents and task force agents. So we don't mouth back to them. But we knew, we knew that it was coming. And when it came, I'm not Holly Hindsight. It was not a surprise. I'm surprised that they didn't do worse, to tell you the truth. But nevertheless, yeah, the DEA response, and like I said, this is not an indictment on DEA. I love DEA. I mean, I can't imagine doing any other job in any other agency. Absolutely. But at that point in time, there was a disconnect, and of course, the price was paid and whatever. And so very, very delayed response.
And we were pushing to two things. We were pushing to get Diaz and his family off island, like, immediately. And there was pushback from DEA about that. Like, who's going to pay for it? You know, VIPD should pay for it. And VIPD had put Diaz and his family up in a hotel, you know, for a few days. And there was a senior agent that was assigned to the task force. I don't know if I'm allowed to say his name, but he's now retired. And, he was a solid guy. And, he eventually became the rack of the office. You know, he basically went in to the rack and maybe even the sack and said, look, you got to do this. There's no question about this. And he's the one that forced their hand and forced them to do it. And had he not done that, I don't think DEA would have done it. And the other thing is, I remember during briefings of this case where Rick and Diaz were doing briefings of this case, the U.S. Attorney's Office and, DEA to try to get assets to investigate these guys who now have been involved in, they're involved in drug trafficking. They're involved in multiple homicides and the torture, murder, dismemberment of a police officer. You know, they're making them aware, we've got source information that's indicating these guys have as much as belt fed weapons. And to them, it was laughable. They didn't. And even with, you would have thought, everybody at the U.S. Attorney's Office would have been, Diaz and his father were very well known on the island. Their restaurant, and the community had done a lot for the, and still continues to do a lot for the Virgin Islands. And the response was minimal. We were still, in my mind, and this is just my opinion, and Rick, I don't know if Rick would agree, but in my mind, it was like we had always been like those other guys over there, not part of a team, not part of anything. We were the odd people. We were a very small group of guys that was targeting people that no one else had the will to do. and to go after. And, you know, here we are doing our job. We've done what they've asked us to do. And when shit hits the fan, now people are arguing who's going to pay for this? Who's going to pay for that?
And so here's how absurd it was. So this goes down. The arguments are like, who's going to pay for Angel and the kids and Carmen to, you know, get off the island or whatever. The protection detail, after that level of violence that was, you know, inflicted, the protection detail, us.
Yeah.
Three or four of us Haida guys. And we had three, I'd say probably roughly three, maybe four Virgin Islands Police Department SWAT guys. And then somebody who was a relative of Angel's was on the department and whatever. And we were the protection detail. And I mean, right. They've been surveilling my house, so I'm also a
we're all targets.
But yeah, so that's the only thing. That's the only people that, and we, whenever, wherever they went, we were like a protection detail. But I will say this much, we had had enough at this point. So when I remember we had to go to the bank for, so when they finally tell Angel, you know, we're going to get you and off the island. Well, Angel had to go to the bank physically to take care of a couple of things. So we go in there and I remember we had our you know, heavy armor. Most of us had maintained very low profiles on that island. I tried to look like some kind of greasy expat. Like we go to the beach, I'm wearing crappy clothes. I'm trying to act just like, you know, but at this point in time now, it looked like Delta rolled into town. We go into that bank and I had the Colt M4 like ready. I had a Colt SMG over my back where you can kind of bring it around, two handguns, heavy armor. And we walk in there to the bank to get Angel taken care of. And the SWAT guy, one of the SWAT guys, really, really big black guy. He was a massive big dude. He had a full auto 12 gauge USAS 12 shotgun. I mean, it looked like it was no joke, right? So we go into that bank and I remember this one gal, who came in that was like a customer. She looks all indignant and she's very well dressed, you know, very, you know, well coiffed or whatever. And she looks at me and she says, "Is this absolutely necessary?" And I looked at her and I said, "Well, if you'd hire the right people and elect the right people to take care of your island, then maybe we wouldn't have to be in here with the guy who had his father almost murdered about 2 days ago. What do you think about that?" And she just looked at the ground the rest of the time, did her business and left. But I mean, I'm a nice guy and I never act like that with anybody unless I have to. But we are all at that point where it's like, are you kidding me with this?
Yeah.
So this is family.
This is family taking care of family.
Well, and I remember they, so, well, they eventually, I don't want to jump ahead, but they eventually, we get information that Rick and the other case agent that was really active, there's contracts out on them too. And DEA's like, at that point, it's like, you're gone, you're done. And so they moved them out. And there was an ATF agent who had just gotten on island and hated it, and his wife hated it. And he decided that he was somehow part of this case that he hadn't worked a day of and that there was a threat against him. And ATF does all court press. They bring in a SWAT team and literally helicopters
and a Blackhawk
yeah. to get this guy out and give him his choice of office. And he had just gotten there.
Yeah. At least somebody's supportive of their agents, you know, right. And this guy, I can tell you what happened, Chris, with this guy. So this agent, there's nothing wrong with the fella. He was a decent guy, right?
Yeah.
His only involvement in this case, we seized a MAC-10, like one of those little tiny little like Ingram MAC-10 type, you know, weapons. And we had to get it test fired to do a function check to make sure it fired full auto from an open bolt. This agent, in this entire case, he'd never done surveillance. All he did was take a MAC-10, point it in a water barrel and go, and then do the little, you know, do with the deal to make sure that it's functioning a couple different ways. And it's like, yeah, it's full auto. That was his entire involvement in the case. And yet this is like the day after the assassination attempt. Blackhawk comes flying in with guys with Styrogs. I think they were customs guys because the customs guys have Styrogs. I think they just grabbed up anybody with Treasury. They were still Treasury Department back then. ATF was still part of Treasury. I think they just said to anybody in Puerto Rico, "Hey, looking for a helicopter ride and take your rifle? I'll go." But yeah, Blackhawk comes in. They take the whole family out.
Yep, whole family gone. And he never came back. Yeah, they sent in a team to pack up his belongings, his house, everything. He didn't have to do anything. He was just gone. And you know, I never left. And Rick and the other case agent, they didn't leave until they were left with no choice. So And I remember we'd have these weekly debriefings on the status of the case, and VIPD was in there. And, you know, to the chief's credit at the time, the chief at the time, to his credit, there was someone for the U.S. Attorney's Office. You know, he started barking off about how he's hearing rumors that we're violating people's civil rights and he doesn't want to hear about this anymore and this and that. And you're talking to guys that had contracts on our lives and just had one of our guys, you know, fathers get shot over work that we're doing. And he's over there preaching to us about how we need to be civil with these, quite frankly, they're animals. There's no other way to describe them, and that we need to be civil with them. And I looked over at the chief at the time, and he kind of smiled at me and he shook his head. No, you don't need to be nice. I was like, all right, well then I know I'm good. But yeah, there were people that were involved in this or somehow on the periphery of this that were, you know, and again, I'm not suggesting that U.S. attorney that was complaining about that was dirty. I'm not saying that, but there was definitely an element of fear, even in the U.S. attorney's office that, you know, these are the same guys that were bitching about jurisdiction, that they wanted to prosecute these cases and we shouldn't be changing venue and bringing these people to the Southern District of Georgia where we could get a solid jury and a solid judge and get convictions. Now all of a sudden they're timid. They're afraid. And so, I mean, for us, it was a super frustrating time. And when Rick and the other case agent, they were forced to relocate, we lost our two most valuable players from DEA side, we were left with at least one or two good ones. But like the whole thing was just like, it was beyond frustrating because we were just spinning our wheels, and now there's this increased pressure to communicate with VIPD. And at this point, we know that there's people in VIPD that are compromised, and yet we're forced to share information with them, and it's a one-way street. We're providing information to them. We're getting nothing in return.
Well, Chris, I don't want to make your pollen count go up or anything on your end, but I'll tell you something. It's a memory of mine whenever I hear this song. So We knew, like, I had like about a day or two where we knew they were thinking about, you know, taking me or getting me off the island. And Chris and I were having a discussion in the Hyde office about, well, where are you going to go if they give you an option or whatever. And I said, well, I'm going to head back because I came from the mountains of Washington State. When I moved down to St. Croix, I was up in the Cascade Mountains. And I told Chris, I'm going to go as far up into whatever mountains as I can, you know, find when I get back. And I'm thinking closer to family, like West Virginia, Northern North Carolina, somewhere in Kentucky, you know, Tennessee, in the mountains, in the foothills there and whatever. And I remember we're sitting there and somebody was streaming music in the background and Country Roads by John Denver comes on. And I have a hard time still telling the story.
That's all right.
Chris looks at me.
That's our theme song, West Virginia.
Chris looks at me and he starts to tear up. And I'd never seen Chris look any other emotion but like either hilarious or serious, you know, like that heart attack serious to do something. But Chris looked at me and he started to tear up and he goes, I never thought it would end like this. And I never heard Chris ever say anything like that before. Every time I hear that stupid song now, I'm like, I'm not crying, you're crying, you know.
I want to just say that I have no recollection of this story at all. And I'm quite sure I didn't tear up because I would never do that. But I remember putting Diaz and his family on that plane and it was like everything had changed and it was like, and it never went back to the way it was. I mean, we still did some really good cases. There were, and some of them were absolutely, just phenomenal cases, but you know, I was in the task force a total of 14 years. And that two year period where Rick was there, we had Joe there, we had Hawk there, you know, those.
And we'll say the name. Gene, you might have known Gene Hawk, LeBron Hawk. Yeah. He went to, what a good man. I'm telling you right now, you had to hold up your 10 fingers in your whole career and say, I want this guy at my back, whether he's in the leadership or on the stack. Gene would have been one of the guys.
Yeah, wow. He was the guy, and he's the one that basically called the DEA and said we need to get him out and fought him. And he was a solid guy, and you know he was going through personal hardships as well, and you know his family didn't stay on island, and he stuck it out for the long haul, and he did, you know, he really, I mean, even as a supervisor, He was still doing casework, and I've met only one other person in my career that was willing to do that. Once you become a supervisor, typically you go away from that, and not him. And he would get good and pissed off if he had people that weren't carrying their own weight, and he would hold them accountable, and he very solid guy.
But I will say on a lighter, I know some of this gets pretty heavy and whatever, but I will say, like, on a lighter note, to just lighten things up for 1 second, when they evacuated Angel and the family off island, they ended up, they didn't have any family back in the States. Most of their family were from, you know, Puerto Rico or from St. Croix. But my mom and dad, I never had children. So my mom and dad, and they had met before, they loved Angel and Carmen and the kids. They're like, well, hey, have them come up with us for a while and what have you. So Angel and the kids, packed their stuff and went north. And by this point in time, I think they had just gotten up there and when they got me off island. And so we all end up meeting in Northern Ohio in wintertime. The kids had never seen snow.
Oh, that's cool.
One of the funny things, I think this is like, it was before Easter. Mom and dad bought the kids these little guns that shot like little colored beads that would explode and make like different colors and just set them loose on the property. Well, they go out, every tree on the property was pink and purple and green, and whoever, it looked like there had been like Al Capone had come in on Valentine's Day Massacre. There was just pink and whatever. But the thing that was the funniest was the kids had never seen snow, never been sled riding before. And so there's it's an honest to God kind of mountainside behind our house. It is really big and steep and long. We take them out there. We're doing that. And Angel and I, of course, we're like, we're going to see who can race the fastest. And, we're going to have a race down the hill. So we're on these really fast luge type sleds. Yep. And the kids are way down at the bottom. And my dad's like most of the way down there with the kids. But he's got my dog, Cammy. And Cammy was my comrade in arms. In Washington State, we'd hike the mountains. I had a climbing harness for her. I would climb and bring her up like ledge to ledge, and she'd wait for me and then go. So she was she was that dog. So Angel and I are flying down this hillside. I mean, we are cooking with gas. And dad accidentally lets the dog that gets loose of him. Well, she doesn't have a time space thing on how fast we're going. She just wants to get ahead of me and like jump on me. She gets in front of the sled. If I would have hit her, it would have broken her legs. I mean, that's how fast we were going. It would have hurt her really badly. So I bite the bullet, right? And I just like bail off the side of the sled. And I have those like halfsy boots, like those hiking boots that are like not full length, but like just above the ankle. I hit the crust and it looked like a guillotine. Broke my leg. And I'm doing somersaults through the air. I mean, it probably looked, it'd been a great YouTube video.
Oh, man.
And whatever. But on Helica in Bombay, you're at the bottom of the mountain, and it's like, USA, USA. they were like cheering. They thought I meant to do the thing or whatever. And, but anyway, that was all. Goodness. Yeah. All good times. Yeah.
Two really quick anecdotal stories about those two. You know, they were, they were like, when they were younger, specifically, they were like family. They were like my kids, you know. And two of my favorite stories, I'll give you one about Angelica and one about Angel. So Angelica was very much tomboy. She used to run with her brother, and those two were very, very close. In fact, when their dad used to drop them off to school when they were really young, he'd make Angel hold Angelica's hand. And I said, how long do you think that lasts? And he goes, just until they turn the corner, then they're going to stop, right? You know, only until they can't see me anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And, I go to the chicken shack or the family restaurant, and, the kids used to have to hang out there all the time when mom and dad were working there. And Angelica sees me and she runs up to the car and she's talking to me. And all of a sudden I see this tropical centipede that's a good 6 inches long walking around the top of her head. And what they had done is they caught the centipede and took off the pinchers on them because you get bit by them. They've got venom and they can jack you up, but they had taken the pinchers off of it. And this little probably 6 year old girl's got a centipede walking around the top of her head. So that tells you, how tough this kid is, but to kind of explain how tight those two were, there was a bully who was messing with Angelica at school, and Diaz gets a call that he needs to come. There's a problem with Angel, right? Well, apparently the teacher intercepted Angel handing a note to the kid, the bully that was bullying his sister. And the teacher opens it up, and written on the piece of paper is, I'm going to f*** you up.
Well, no question about what he meant, is there?
Yeah, and if, you met, if you met Bobby, he's such a nice young man. He was like a totally unassuming, nice kid, sweet little boy. Just a sweet word, sweet boy. Sweet little boy, just a good little kid. So,
But you couldn't mess with his sister, you know? So it was such a good – one of my favorite stories, I was like a bad influence on those kids because I thought it was the greatest thing ever. And Angel was trying to, you know, be a responsible parent and tell him he can't do things like that. And I was like, no, you do that every time. It's not like he beat him up or anything, you know, but yeah, it's one of my favorite stories with those kids.
Oh, yeah. You got to love kids. My two daughters, I got a call from the school resource officer one time when they were in high school. And the older one, who's only 4'11", looking out for her younger ones when somebody picked on her on the bus, you know, and the deputy calls me and it's, you know, well, I said, what was said? Well, talked about killing somebody, leaving them in the ditch. That's my girl. guys, this is, you know, I mean, we could probably do another 2 hours with all the tales that you guys have. It's unbelievable what you've been through. It's unbelievable that you survived. I got to say, only by God's grace, in my opinion, are we sitting here talking to you two guys today. And Chris, you've got more adventures in your life, but we're going to wait a while. We'll bring you back on for a later show to talk about that. Just because we're not going to put anybody in a bad position right now. But before we finish this up, as exciting as all of this has been, and I'll start with whichever one of you guys wants to go first. What advice would you have for anybody that's maybe looking to go into law enforcement or just life in general? You know, we always talk about no matter what the situation, don't give up. You guys are living proof that you don't give up. But what advice would you have for folks out there listening? Chris, we'll go with you first.
You know, I think my career was – I was given opportunities that I probably would never have had if I had gone any place other than the Virgin Islands. I was fortunate enough to have some really good people early on that kind of took me under the wing, Pete Anderson, Jimmy DiCaprio, and, you know, guys like that, that really, I was honored to work with them. Diaz, Rambo, all, you know, the list goes on, Abraham, there's a lot of them along the way. And I was extremely fortunate. And I think that if I had any advice is, you know, there's things that happen in your life that you can never make the connections looking forward. You know, you only can make them looking back. And I think that a lot of those connections that I made early on, they made a profound difference in my life, you know, even to this day. And you know, cases, they'll come and go, but the brotherhood you make in law enforcement, that lasts forever. I mean, you know, Rick, I see him about once a year at SHOT Show, but we talk all the time. And, you know, it was 2 years that, you know, we worked together, but he's like as much of my brother as any of these guys. And you know, Diaz, all those guys. So, like I said, cases, they come and go, but the connections you make with people, that's the sort of thing that'll last a lifetime. And I would say, don't take anything for granted. And if you're provided information or you learn something, you know, do the right thing and pay that forward and provide it to the next generation that's coming up. So
excellent advice. How about you, Rick?
Well, I have two things. One would be if you decide to go into law enforcement or whatever career you go into, this is more of like a tactical advice. Always obey your intuitions. If you feel something is wrong, it's wrong. If you feel something is dangerous, it's dangerous. When you get a read on people, especially after you've been in the field for a couple of years and whatever, always obey because your intuitions are one of the strongest things that you're going to have. So if you become, whether you're a psychologist or a cop or a teacher, whatever you go into, always obey those intuitions because they will usually serve you well. When it comes to being in law enforcement, I would say that the cruel reality of it is that you may never see the good that you do. And you'll see a lot of, you know, as a line officer, as a patrol officer, you're going to see, you know, some of the ugliest sides of humanity. And as an agent, you will as well. If you go into the federal system as a deputy marshal or whatever, you'll see some things that will shake you to your core, no matter how resilient you are, questioning humanity and how can this happen in the world that we live in and whatever. But conversely, you will meet the best of people, like Chris said. You'll meet people from all different walks of life. They don't have to be other cops in your travels. The people that you meet that will restore that faith and everything. And you need, and I think the final thing I'd say is you need to understand that the good that you do, you know, the sacrifices and your family sacrifices as well with you. With it, you know, when you go through this, your family are wondering where you are. They're worried. They're, you know, worried about you and whatever else. But everything that you do, the lives you save, you may never see that child that wasn't accidentally shot in a drive-by because, you know, you end up taking out a really good, you know, really good viable target and putting him in federal prison or a local prison for 5 or 10 years, taking them out of the equation. All the good that you do, you may never see somebody who didn't overdose and die from fentanyl because you took the people out of the equation that were the people that killed them. But you need, I think, so I tell younger cops this, just understand you're doing it. You may never see the fruits of your labor or whatever, but by the time the end of your career rolls around, it would be hard to quantify how many people that you saved, how many lives you saved, lives you changed. If you go talk at schools and talk to young kids, how that lasts, how kids listen to what you have to say. If you're walking a patrol beat, like in Pittsburgh, we had a lot of young men that would stop my partner and I. We'd have 12 or 14 young men, like, you know, anywhere from like 10 to 15 years old, sitting on city steps, just wanting to hear about, like, Chuck, he's a Marine, my partner, my cop partner, wanting to hear about what the Marines are like, or wanting to hear about this or whatever. It didn't take a whole lot to satisfy these, you know, kids to have somebody in their life that could talk to them. But anyway, the things that you do in your career, how far that'll go, you may never see it, but it's there. And it's an important, important mission.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, and I'm not going to let you go just yet. I got a couple more questions. One is, whatever happened to Fluffy's dad? Was he convicted and sent to prison?
Yeah, he did. I think he got 35 years. So
good.
You know,
federal
time. Yeah.
And I guess it has to be said, Steve, probably if people visit the website, they'll see the after photos when we became friends, fast friends. Yep. with Fluffy. If they check out the website, you should see the Chris and I with our new best bro. And those pictures were taken right after we effected the entry in the search warrant on the main property across from that Ritz-Carlton hotel that we talked about before.
Well, and not only pictures of Fluffy, but you'll see pictures of Earl on our website too. That's gamecrimespodcast.com. Come and check it out. And then before we go here, Chris, can you tell us what you're doing now after you finished your career in law enforcement?
I don't know to what degree I can talk about that, but
you're in security and private industry. Is that fair to say?
I'm here and there.
Yeah.
So
sounds like he's a freaking spy, doesn't it?
We have any theme music. We talked about that. We can play things in the background, any kind of theme music we can play.
I'll see what I can do. And Rick, tell us what you're up to, buddy.
Well, totally by accident, I retired, and after 5 days, I received a phone call. And it's kind of like the mafia when you work in like law enforcement. Sometimes you can't really ever like blood in, blood out. But I end up accidentally picking up a retirement job. I'm a law enforcement coordinator for the state of Alaska, and we do like all of the things for deconflicting operational events in Alaska. So if, like, say the marshals are going to run out and do a top 15 most wanted in town here in Anchorage, then maybe the APD homicide unit is, you know, out there doing their thing. Spatially, we'll let them know where they are. And we also do a lot of equipment loans. We do a bunch of like behind the scenes things for law enforcement to help them out. And then the second thing is I write, and I'm an editor for the Outdoor Sportsman Group. I specifically editor with Firearms News Magazine, their hunting editor, but do some things across the boards with them, and also as a presenter with Guns and Ammo Television and a couple other projects.
There you go. And for our listeners, I tried to find Chris on social media and could not find him anywhere. You can see, or you could hear, he's a little bit secretive, a little bit hesitant to talk about certain things. But I mentioned earlier that I do want to bring Chris on for another episode down the road. And it could be a year or two down the road, but there's so much more to his story that we're just not allowed to talk about right now. Am I making up excuses for him? Maybe. But we're going to respect his privacy. I couldn't find him anyway, so there's nothing I could tell you. But Rick, I was able to find you on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, all at Rick Rambo. And it's RIKK and then RAMBO. So if you guys want to find out more about these two, I'm hoping that Chris, at some point, buddy, I'm hoping you'll publish your books, because that one transcript you sent me, I told you it took me less than 2 days to get that read. It was fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, hopefully we'll get there someday. Yeah. I got to find a publisher first.
Well, you and about 2,000 other police officers here in the United States, because I get phone calls all the time. But I tell you what I'll do is I will introduce you to Patrick O'Donnell, retired sergeant from Milwaukee PD, old-time copper, has a podcast called Cops and Writers. He's a writer himself. I mean, he got contracted to do a three-book series. He's a very, very good writer. And he gives classes to law enforcement, doesn't charge anything, on how to write a book, how to get it edited, published, all that kind of stuff. So we'll make that introduction for you, and you can pick his brain.
Okay. Thank you.
And I just want to give a quick shout out to families. We refer to them as our unsung heroes. You heard what these guys went through. If you go back and listen to Rick's original interview here on the Game of Crimes, he talks about how he had to barricade his apartment or his house, wherever he was living. And his wife is down there with him. Now, you heard these guys, he doesn't have any kids down there with him. And I'm sure Chris went through the same thing, but, you know, we go out and we do the things that we think are important, we think that the good man upstairs has given us the ability to do and given us the guts to go do them. And then we just expect our families to put up with our crap. We come home bitchy and grumpy. You know, I had a bad day. Don't talk to me. Or keep the home fires burning. In my case, we had kids that my wife was taking care of. So just want to give a shout out to our unsung heroes out there that put up with our crap and allow us to do what it is we do. You are just as important as any of these studs that I bring on the show. Our families are equally important, if not more so, because they give us the ability to continue to do what we would do. All right, guys, I'm going to call it an end to this four-part episode here. It's been a hoot having you two on here. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for the stories, for your transparency. I know there's a lot of things that we could have talked about, but, you know, nobody wants to get sued, and that's not what this is about. Bringing these heroes on the show, what it's about is showing you the bravery, the commitment, the sacrifice that's required to get the job done. And if you want to be in law enforcement, if you want to be in the military, if you want to be a first responder, that's what it takes. Don't think it's easy. It's not. So all our listeners, thank you so much for coming back every week. I appreciate your support. Rick and Chris, God bless you, brothers. I'm so happy you came back on the show, Rick. And Chris, it's great to meet you and finally get you on the show.
Thanks for having us on, Steve. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Absolutely. For our listeners, thank you guys for coming back every week. Check us out on patreon.com/gameofcrime. There's a lot of fun things we do over there. And if you're listening to this, go over to YouTube, type in Game of Crimes podcast in the search bar, hit that subscribe button, watch some of the episodes, hit the like button, send me your comments. In the meantime, I'm going to try and figure out why you folks continue to come back and listen to this redneck hillbilly talk every week. But I really know why you do it, because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, and that's the Game of Crimes. God bless. See you folks next week.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hey, Central Ohio. The nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.